Today's Teisho is entitled, it's on case 52 in the Book of Serenity. Case 52 is entitled Kaoshan's Reality Body. Those who have wisdom can understand by means of metaphors. If you come to where there is no possibility of comparison or similitude, how can you explain it to them? Kaoshan asked Elder De, the Buddha's true reality is like space. It manifests form in response to beings, like the moon in the water. How do you explain the principle of response? De said, like an ass looking in a well. Kaoshan said, you said a lot indeed, but you only said 80%. De said, what about you, teacher? Kaoshan said, like the well looking at the ass. First, the ass looks at the well. The well looks at the ass. Wisdom is all-embracing. Purity pervades with abundance. Behind the elbow, who discerns the seal? In the house, no books are kept. The loom threads aren't strung, the work of the shuttle. The pattern going vertically and horizontally, the meaning is distance of itself. So this is the third day of our January 2019 session. And again, I want to thank everybody for such beautiful, beautiful practice this morning. It's definitely the case that we could, we could certainly do a kinhin in the middle of the morning. But I think, it would really interrupt our concentration. It's really quite extraordinary how well people can sit in the morning when we have these three extended sits like this. And, I'm well aware that everybody's been sitting 9 hours the previous day, 8 or 9 hours the previous day. My legs are tired too, but there's just, it's absolutely priceless to be able to sit with that depth and intensity. And I'm so happy to see everybody do that. It's really extraordinary. Every once in a while, if we have new people here, I'm tempted to try introducing a kinhin in the middle. But, something in me always says, don't do it, I mean, I don't think a kinhin is going to make them stay, actually. And they'll miss the chance to have this really, really deep engagement. It's okay to be straining a little bit. It's okay to be straining a little bit. I don't think people understand this, in our culture. I was reading something that recently. By a writer I don't like very much, and her name is Amy Chua. And Amy Chua is the author of this book on the tiger mother, the superior Chinese mother, and how she pushes her children and humiliates them and so on and so on, and they turn out really well. First of all, I know many Chinese mothers who don't humiliate their children. And so on. So I think she's selling her own brand of Chinese motherhood. But she, in spite of the fact that I don't like her very much after reading her book, she does make one important point. In America, we tend to believe that people have a talent for something. We have a talent for something. And at a certain level, that may be true. For example, you could take five children and you could train them all, and maybe one of them would turn out to be a Glenn Gould pianist, right? But really, much of excellence comes from effort. And you know, I think I'm a pretty good writer, you know, but 50 years ago I wasn't a pretty good writer. You know, I've been writing almost every day for 50 years, and I think I've gotten to be a good writer. Sometimes people will say to me, "Man, you're a good writer." And I assure you, it's not talent. If you could have seen what I wrote in college, you'd think, this guy's never going to be much of a writer. But, you know, I teach writing, too. And so, you know, I'm writing and teaching writing and writing. And I think I'm a pretty damn good writer. And I don't think talent has much to do with it, you know. I think a lot of it is just application. And Amy Chua was saying that, you know, that Westerners, Americans especially, believe in talent. You know, so you know, you'll hear people say, "Well, my daughter just isn't good in math. She's good in this." And it's like, you know, that means she's hardwired genetically not to be good in math. And that's crazy, right? I mean, it's possible that at the level of you know, very advanced Dirac-type mathematics, you know, that level, super, super mathematicians, there it matters that you have a certain something, right? But actually, for most people, you know, it's really application. And this is especially, well, it's true in anything. You know, I remember reading an interview with Georgia O'Keeffe. And Georgia O'Keeffe was asked, "How did you get to be, you know, the greatest American painter of your generation?" And she said, you know, when I during the formative years of my life, you know, when I was living on Lake George with Stiglitz, Joseph Stiglitz, you know, I spent like, you know, 18 hours a day painting, you know. So, you know, basically, she would get up in the morning and start painting, and she would paint all day. And then, you know, they'd get up the next day and she'd start painting again. And Stiglitz would be developing his photographs. And that kind of dedication made her a super good artist, you know. And you know, it wasn't talent. You know, nobody, actually, there probably isn't such a thing as talent in the way we imagine. You know, what made her a great artist was drawing, painting. What makes you know, a writer, you know, is writing and reading. You know, whenever I send an article, you know, sometimes I will come into my class and I will say, you know, my students don't really know how to revise their work. And I'll bring in a big stack of paper, and I'll say, "This is one article." And they'll look at it like, "Huh?" Because it's like 150 pages. And then I'll say, "Actually, the article is 25 pages, but this is five drafts, and I didn't even bring the whole thing." And so, you know, I try to show them that I write something, I don't like it, I rewrite it, I throw it out, I add something new. It's writing. You know, painting. Well, you know, when it comes to something like meditation practice, you know, people also kind of have this idea that it should be, it's a matter of talent, or it's a matter of, it should be effortless. You know, and so, you know, many people, yesterday I was talking about the mindfulness craze, right? And, you know, it will have this, these articles will say, you know, just 15 minutes a day, you know, you can solve all your problems, you know, you could, and it seems to me very self-deluding, you know. And if you're just meditating so that you won't have a nervous breakdown, if your goal is just to avoid having a nervous breakdown, even then 15 minutes a day is probably not going to be good enough. But you're certainly not going to get any insight into your barriers. And you're certainly not going to get work through any of your barriers. So you know, when it comes to meditation, you know, people just think of this as something that should be effortless. I should be able to sit down, watch my breath, and feel better. Case closed. And it's possible that's true, but if it's true, it's not good for you, right? I mean, you could also, snort Coke. You could sit down, have a snort of Coke, and you'd feel better, you know. But that's not necessarily good for you, right? Another dimension to this has to do with Western religious traditions, you know. In Western, and I'm not criticizing anybody's religious traditions, but in Western religious tradition, Jesus was born the Son of God. So he was, by virtue of his birth, already divine. That's rather different, I would say, from the story of the Buddha. Because, you know, even though it does say in later Buddhism that the Buddha was, you know, reincarnated many times and so on and so on, you know, in order to wake up, he had to do a lot of sitting. In other words, he had to do it through hard work. You know, the Buddha practiced single-mindedly for 6 years. And that meant, just like Georgia O'Keeffe getting up in the morning and painting all day at Lake George, you know, the Buddha got up all day and meditated, from just like we do to here, you know. This session is going to be over in 2.5 days. And the Buddha meditated sort of like non. He did a session for 6 years, right? And took it really seriously. He studied with the best teachers before he went on his long session. He studied with some of the best meditation teachers in India at the time. So you know, the Buddha's enlightenment wasn't, you know, effortless. He had to work really hard to wake up. And he wasn't, by virtue of his birth, already enlightened. He didn't have a talent for enlightenment. He had to work. And so, you know, I definitely think that this is a dimension of meditation practice that we have, that especially people in the West have a hard time with, you know. Somebody in our group was saying that she talks about our meditation class in her yoga class, and she said, yes, you know, it's a wonderful. Our meditation group is really wonderful. You should come and try it. And you know, people look very intrigued. And then she says, you know, we meet at 7 a.m. on Sunday in Stanhope, and people look at her like, you know, she just said, basically, I'm going to drive a truck over you. It's like, what? 7 a.m.? And they say things like, well, I could never do that, right? It's like, I could never do that. It's like, what are you talking about, you know? And of course you could. People are capable of change. If you were developing, like, athletic skill, you'd say, I expect to run half a mile this week. You know, I'll run three times this week, half a mile. And I'll do that for a month. And then I'll add another half mile. And then I'll do another half mile and another half mile until I'm, like, you know, running like 3.5 miles, which is that's a nice run. And if you really get into it, you know, you get to enjoy that runner's high, maybe, you know, like 4 or 5 miles, you know, when you really get the buzz on, right? And so people expect that with physical exertion, but somehow, you know, the way meditation has been sold, people don't expect it to be something where you deepen your abilities, right? You deepen your abilities, and you become like a different kind of person. And just as, you know, at first, if you've never done much running, you know, the first, you know, week you go for a run twice or three times a week, you know, you get up the next day, it's like, oh, whoa, I'm so sore, right? Oh, my legs, they're so sore, you know. And you kind of expect that challenge, you know, you expect to be challenged when you do running. Well, it's the same thing with meditation practice, right? I mean, basically, you challenge yourself. At first, you know, you can sit for 15 minutes. And then it would be a good idea to add another 15 minutes. And, you know, at the university, people who first start coming on a Monday night, you know, after 35 minutes, man, they're done. You know, and then we do Keenheen, and they do another 35 minutes. There was a guy who was coming. There was a guy who was coming this fall. He started coming, and I don't know who he is, but he was actually an Indian American guy, and he would come and sit through the first sit, and then we'd get up for Keenheen, and we'd come back, and I'd look around the room and think, huh, I thought we had 12 people here, but there's only like 11. It took me a while to realize he was ducking out after the Keenheen. So one time he came in and I actually said to him, I said, listen, you've been coming for, you know, one sit each time you come. I said, please, stay for the second sit, you know, please. And he kind of went, you know, I said, no, please, you know, really. So I sort of begged him to stay and he had no choice, you know, so he stayed. And afterwards I said, wasn't that great? And then he never came back. So it's like, people who don't come to Sesshin, right? It's like you run half a mile and somebody says, come on, let's run a mile. No, I only do half a mile. Only half a mile. That's it. You know, first of all, you're not going to get in very good shape if you run only half a mile for the rest of your life, right? And, you know, you don't explore the experience of running in a sustained way. So it's the same thing with Sesshin, right? I mean, there's an element here of application. And, you know, I'm always surprised that there was a guy who came one Saturday. He was sitting with another group, and he came to our Saturday sit. I've been saying to him, come on, why don't you come to one of our Saturday sits? You know, come on. And so he showed up at 7 in the morning. He somehow got up at 7 in the morning, which was excellent. And he came to the sit. He stayed through the whole thing, but I've never seen him again. And I think it was just a little bit too much for him. But, you know, when something's a little bit too much for you, I think the wrong response is to say, oh, I could never do this, see? Oh, this is beyond me. See, what you're doing is you're saying, I have an absolute limit I cannot change. And the whole point of meditation is that you are actually a Buddha, you know, but you're not a Buddha right now, right? And so you know, the point is, you know, to get from A to B means, you know, basically improving your performance and deepening your practice. And it's definitely the case that people can totally transform themselves. And it may be maybe that Americans don't have a lot of self-confidence also. But you develop self-confidence by breaking through your barriers, right? By breaking through your barriers. You know, there were long, long ago, maybe 20 years ago, there was a woman who came to Sesshin, and in those days, I used to just do, sometimes late at night, I would let Dokusan go on a little too long. So now we're much stricter about when we end Dokusan, but if I were in a Dokusan with somebody, and it could go on for 10 or 15 minutes, you know, basically people wouldn't be leaving this room or leaving the Zen hall until like 10:45. And the next day, a woman came into Dokusan and she was furious with me. She said, "You left us sitting there for 15 more minutes." And she was just so hopping mad. And I said, "Yeah, but you survived, you know, you survived, right? And the amazing thing is you did it, you know." And I don't think I got through to her, but you know, because again, never came back, right? But the idea of saying setting an arbitrary boundary, this is beyond this, I cannot go. I mean, imagine if your kids said that, right? "I'm sorry, mother, but algebra is just beyond me. Beyond arithmetic, I will not go." You would say, "No, you're going to do you're going to learn algebra, right?" I mean, because we know that would be crazy, right? That children can learn algebra, right? They can, and you know what? They can even learn trigonometry. They can learn calculus. You know, it's not beyond them, right? It's definitely, it's hard. You know, I can remember when I started to do algebra in junior high school, I remember going to my father and saying, "I don't know how to do this." And he had done it like 50 years ago, you know, before he, and he said, "Oh, I can do that." You know, and he sat there, I remember him trying to work through this problem and crossing it out and starting to swear and here you take it. I don't know, you know. So, you know, it's challenging if you have, you know. I mean, at first I didn't even understand. It didn't make any sense to me that there were these letters. You know, I can understand numbers, but what are the letters doing there, you know? So algebra took me some time to figure out. But even though I failed my first algebra test, you know, I really got like straight A's in algebra after applying myself. So it's the same thing in meditation practice. If you apply yourself, you can do amazing things. And there's something about the way Americans think about meditation, they don't expect to have to apply themselves, right? They expect this to be something that is like a resource for when you're tired and frazzled, this will soothe your nerves. But meditation is not, at least Zen meditation, is not about that. You know, Zen meditation is about breaking through our barriers and becoming fully awake. And so it's an ambitious project. But it's definitely what we're all about, you know. So, naturally, on day two of Sesshin, people's legs hurt and so on. And you know, everybody who's done Zen has had the experience of saying, at 9 o'clock, you know, that's it, I cannot go any farther. But, you know, then you have some tea, you go to the bathroom, you come back, you sit down, and you find you have another hour in you. Basically, you can sit longer than you thought. And it's like, just like, you know, you do half a mile, and then you think, "Oh, I don't know if I could do a mile." And you do a mile, and you think, "God damn it, I did a mile." So you know, much of Zen practice, like in yoga, like, you know, yoga is about, you know, you have limited flexibility, and you stretch yourself to a certain point, and that's your comfort zone. If you say, "Nope, beyond that point, I will not go. See, you never get flexible, right? You know, what you have to do is you have to flex yourself a little bit more and flex yourself a little bit more. And, you know, pretty soon your range of motion is much greater and you have much more suppleness, right? But every step in your yoga practice is a little bit challenging. And actually, you don't want to hurt yourself, but it's going to, you know, stretching stretches, right? It's definitely uncomfortable to be in that zone. If you're not working the zone, you're not going anywhere. So it's also, this is also the case with meditation practice. If you just could sit down on the cushion and be in your happy place, that nothing could be gained from that. You know, there are real challenges to meditation practice, you know, and people read about challenges. You know, I don't know if you saw the movie Doctor Strange, right? But, Doctor Strange is a doctor whose hands are damaged and he goes to in an accident. He's a surgeon, an arrogant surgeon, and he goes to Nepal and he's drafted into this sort of like a coterie of mystical masters, and he winds up saving the universe from a time-devouring being. Negative energies are about to overwhelm the universe, and Doctor Strange saves the universe, you know. And, you know, he has many trials and tribulations, you know, which all involve magical forces and so on. Or if you saw The Hobbit, you know, basically when they have to go deep inside the mountain, they encounter monsters the wizard has to use his magical powers and so on. You know, that's fantasy, right? That's fantasy. But, you know, when you're doing Zen practice, you know, you have to use your powers to face real foes, right? Real obstacles, you could say, right? So, you know, unfortunately, in Zen, we don't know how to take pentagrams and make them spin in a circle in space, right? But what we can do is confront our physical obstacles, our pain and our fatigue, and not be overwhelmed by that, but push through by tapping into the breath and using the energy of mu, our ki or chi energy or prana. You know, you think, I cannot sit another moment, and then you breathe out and this energy arises and your resolution is restored and you push through the obstacle, see? And that's a great victory. You know, that's a great victory. That's like Gandalf, you know, doing something, I don't know. But then we encounter inner, you know, you could say psychological obstacles too. You know, there can be various kinds of psychological obstacles. Some of them are have all these mental habits that they bring to practice. So for example, you know, maybe you tend to be very self-critical. So, you know, when you get stuck on your koan, you might begin to be very down on yourself and say, you know, I knew I was never going to be cut out for... You say, I knew I didn't have any talent for enlightenment, right? You know, and you can be down on yourself about your failure to answer your koan. And you can look around the zendo and everybody else is answering their koans and you're wondering, why am I not able to answer my koans, right? Or some people get angry. You know, I've definitely had people become angry doing Zen practice. It's definitely the case that you confront obstacles that probably have been deeply ingrained in your behavior all your life. And it's not like you can make the pentagrams spin around or there's a magic lasso or something or a cape you can put on and all your obstacles are going to go away. It takes a lot of work to get through those obstacles. It takes many sesshins to work through our obstacles. So you know, that's real life challenge, real life magic, you know. And also, you know, we have other kinds of challenges. People can have somatic issues when they're practicing. In other words, you know, sometimes you can have a somatic response to what's happening on the cushion. You know, Webb, my beloved second teacher, Glenn Webb Roshi, studied in Japan at a temple called Myoshinji. And Webb had gone to Myoshinji just because he wanted to study. He was an art historian doing his research. He was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, and he was doing his research on this very famous Japanese painting called The Five Persimmons. And The Five Persimmons is like a masterpiece of Japanese art. It's like the Mona Lisa of, or of, it's like Van Gogh's wheat painting, you know, or apple orchard painting. It's a masterpiece of Japanese art. And he went to, it belongs to this temple. And he went to the temple and he said to the abbot, I want to do my research on the Five Persimmons. I'd like to see it. Will I be able to do that? And the abbot said, no. And Webb said, what do you mean? And he said, you can't see it unless you do Zazen. Because there's no way you could even understand this painting unless you did Zazen. So he blackmailed him, basically. And Webb sort of, okay, I'm game, you know, I'll do Zazen. And it's like many years later, you know, he became a monk, he trained at Myoshinji. And eventually he got to see the painting. But the thing is, you know, sometimes Webb would pass out, you know, and he also sometimes would throw up and pass out. So if you know anything about Buddhist temples in Japan, people don't sit on the floor the way we do. Also in China, it's often the case they sit on something called a tan. So actually, people sit on these elevated platform. It's about 2.5 feet off the ground. So when you come in, you sit down on your cushion, but your cushion is on a platform, and the row of cushions is on this platform. Underneath the platform, there are there's like storage area for your gear. You know, you can put your shoes under there, and anyway, people sit on those, and you know, basically, you know, Webb would just, you know, basically throw up. He'd lean over and throw up, and then he'd pass out. And I said to him, "Well, what did you do? What did they do?" And he said, "They just put me back, propped me back." You know, it's like onward. You know, but you know, basically, he speaks of that time as incredibly liberating period in his life. And of course, Webb had his Daikensho experience long ago. You know, so, I mean, you're going through a process that is actually reconstructing who you are, you know, remaking who you are. You are a collection of energy habits. It's not science fiction. That's what the sutras call it, energy habits. You know, and how you organize your physical energy is all part of something you've done for all your life, right? So, you know, different people have different energy habits. You know, so for example, when some people are tense, they get headaches. This is like a somatic response to their tension, right? When other people get tense, they get fidgety. You know, so you'll see somebody who's tense and he's taking his pencil and he's tapping it on the table and he's twirling the pencil like a baton between his fingers. You know, those two responses are not probably hardwired. They're ways people learned how to deal with their tension. They built their energy habits a certain way. So, you know, some people have headaches that get worse when they're in tense situations. Some people have nausea, you know. Some people don't. And some people do other things. Some people develop smoking habits, you know. So people who have stress, sometimes they've learned to cope with stress by somatizing it by having a stomach ache or having a headache, but they crave pleasure. So when they feel stressed, they've decided the way to deal with stress is to crave pleasure. So, you know, when they're stressed, they eat a candy bar or they smoke. You know, smoking is, please don't smoke, but smoking is all about rewarding yourself, right? Because you do get a rush from the nicotine. So you know, people who are stressed, and one way to deal with that stress is to say, okay, I'll put up with the stress for now, but I'm going to relax, and I'm going to have a shot of nicotine, and I'm going to feel like I'm soaring for a while. See, so these are different strategies for dealing with obstacles. And people build their bodies in different ways from childhood on, right? So, you know, basically, you know, some people go to the bathroom every 3 days, and some people go to the bathroom 3 times a day. And some of that is maybe the way their digestive system works, but it's really very complicated. You know, it's actually, a lot of it is how they've coped with certain things in their life, you know. Many things are like that, you know. Some people, as soon as they feel stressed, their heart rate goes through the ceiling. And some people can be in the middle of stress and be very calm. You know, I've been doing meditation for a long time. About 15 years ago, I was getting some rocks for my fish pond, and a rock rolled over my hand and didn't crush 3 of my fingers, but it basically sliced them open. So I drove myself down Route 78 to a hospital, and I went into the emergency room, and I sat there, and I came in with my hand, and they took my blood pressure and my heart rate, and the nurse said, "That is really remarkable. You know, your pulse is like, you know, 58 or something, and your blood pressure is quite normal." You know, and I didn't say, "Oh, that's because I do zazen," but it was because I do zazen, right? So you know, you're really changing the way your body distributes its energies. And it's like rebuilding the human from the ground up in very elemental ways. We think of the body just as this physical entity. But you know, here it's called, I think they call it the Dharma body, right? Isn't that what they call it? It's also reality body. It's also, you Tibetans say, subtle body, your subtle body. So you know, we're really changing the subtle body as we meditate. And this is really and truly a realignment of the body's energies. And when you do that, you realize, of course, that you're not disconnected from the world around you. One of the things that you experience on the cushion is that the boundary between yourself and the world begins to dissolve, and you feel connected to things around you. This is like the great body, right? And when you begin to realign your energies, you stop feeling so isolated. You feel deeply connected to all the things around you. This process has quite radical effects as you go on. You know, I'll never forget we were sitting in the Zendo, and there was thunder and lightning. And then I went into the Dokusan room, and I said to the Roshi, wow, there's a lot of thunder and lightning. And Genki Roshi said, wait till you realize that that's coming out of your own body. And at the time I thought, huh? You know, what? You know. But, you know, eventually, if you're in deep samadhi and you hear a bird sing, where is that coming from? It feels like it's coming right out of yourself. You know, we know intellectually that we're connected to everything. It's a cliche, right? We know intellectually everything's interconnected, interbeing, etc. But, you know, actually, we don't live that way because our culture has made us very isolated creatures. And we've learned to align our energies in very limiting and crippling and isolating ways. So, you know, doing Zazen is going to change that. And along the way, you know, you're going to have challenges that involve working through your psychological obstacles and sometimes your somatic obstacles. But, you know, a little pain in the legs is not a big deal. I mean, it's really not. And you know, also, there are some somatic consequences of sitting, you know, that you know, they're a small price to pay. Right? I mean, it's small, we all have them, right? I have them too, you know. But you know, it's a small price to pay. Kaoshan asked Elder Du, the Buddha's true reality body is like space. It manifests form in response to beings, like the moon in the water. How do you explain the principle of response? De said, like an ass looking into a well. So that's like your small mind looking at your big mind, basically, see. So at first, on day two of the Sesshin, or day three of Sesshin, when you're working with the Mu Koan, or you're facing that blankness, you're like an ass looking into a well. You know, you look down into the well, and you know, you might see your face reflected there, and you might not, but it just looks like a dark, blank space. Kaoshan said, you said a lot indeed, but you only said 80%. De said, what about you, teacher? Kaoshan said, well, if you keep practicing Zazen, the well will look back at you. In other words, once you activate your big mind, it will reach in, it will reach through and touch you, see. So everybody is practicing quite superbly. And all of you are looking down into the well, and the well is going to look back at you. And that will be a wonderful thing. So please keep up the good work.